This past summer, the NYPD issued a report warning of a growing risk posed by homegrown terrorists. One of the cases they cited was that of the so-called Lackawanna Six. NPR's FBI correspondent Dina Temple-Raston spent 3 years exploring that story, specifically what led six American citizens to leave upstate New York for an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan. In her new book, The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror, she opens a window into the lives of these young men who were often torn between their Muslim heritage and their American home. It is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Temple, Miss Temple Raston, is that how I'm going to say? Because you say exactly. Miss, you say Miss on your web page, not Ms. I was very surprised, to this show. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. You can call me Dina.
Okay, Dina. Two of your previous books, A Death in Texas and Justice on the Grass, dealt with issues related to race. What drew you to this story?
It was actually more of the same. My editor once said that I only write about sort of very heavy topics. And the first book was about the James Byrd murder in Jasper, Texas. And so it was about white-on-black racism. And then the second book was about Rwanda. And I wanted to see if there was a difference between black-on-black prejudice and white-on-black racism. And this book actually fits in with those other two in the sense that I wanted to take a look at what it was like to be Muslim in America today. And there's an expression in the black community that you are born suspect. And now I think post 9/11, Muslim Americans and Muslims more generally are just having that same problem. And I wanted to explore that.
There's been much talk about Islamofascism in the Republican debates. And I've heard that some college conservative groups have named this Islamofascism Awareness Week.
Really? I hadn't heard that. Aren't I lucky my book's out?
So that would suggest it's become much worse for Muslim Americans, whether they are radicals or not.
Indeed. I mean, what's interesting about the Lackawanna Six case, I think, is that it actually allows us to take a look at how justice in America has actually been meted out post 9/11. And the case I've been making is that actually the Lackawanna Six case is the perfect case study for looking at that. Because you have people who actually use the justice system and pled guilty. You have somebody who ended up in Guantanamo Bay. And you've got someone else who was summarily executed in the deserts of Yemen. All that had to do with this story. So as a reader, you sort of get to decide where you draw the line, where you start to feel like maybe we've gone off the rails a little bit in the justice that we mete out.
Well, considering what happened in the UK, do you worry about the threat of homegrown American terrorism?
Absolutely. You're talking about the 7/7 attacks in the UK,
yes.
the bus and the subway. Absolutely. I think it is the next phase of this. And the fact that we haven't had more homegrown terrorism is actually quite surprising. I think everyone would say that, whether you're the FBI correspondent or not.
But you're asking, is it possible to come up with a fair balance between dealing with the threat of terrorism and an individual civil liberties?
You know, I tend to think that what makes America great is that we always hold ourselves up to a higher standard. And in terms of the higher standard of justice, I'm not entirely sure post 9/11 that we're still holding ourselves up to that standard.
There is, I think The Onion this week has a headline, did you see it?
No.
That American jihadists are threatening to wrap the Sears Tower in Jell-O.
Again?
In your opinion, did the Lackawanna Six pose a real threat?
In my opinion, I think that the Lackawanna Six, we tend to talk about them as if they were six, all the same people, amorphous Lackawanna Six. They all felt the same way. And the book deals with those gray areas. Do I think that if someone went to an al-Qaeda camp, and remember they went before 9/11, which I think there's a huge bright line between people who went before and afterwards, because afterwards you really can't say I didn't know what it was about. So they go to the camps. They actually learn how to use plastic explosives. Some of them leave early because they realize it's an anti-American camp. Some of them stay for all of the training. And then they come back and they plan nothing. That's what makes them different. They're not like the Fort Dix people. They plan nothing. But if you know how to use plastic explosives, can we risk it? Can we let you out there if you actually – and the book actually poses that question, whether we feel comfortable if you've done something like that, whether you can just go free.
My guest is Dina Temple Raston, whose latest book is The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror, published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Were all six born in the United States?
No, the majority, they were all Americans. Let me put it that way. They were all naturalized Americans. They voted Democratic. They had jobs. They went to American high schools and elementary schools. They played on soccer teams with Americans. But they lived in this part of Lackawanna that was very isolated. It was called the First Ward, and it was essentially a Yemeni-American community. And what most people probably don't know about Lackawanna, which is just outside of Buffalo, is that it's the second largest Muslim community in America after Detroit. Who would think? I mean, if I were a Muslim, I'm not sure I would immediately go to the shores of Lake Erie where it's so cold.
Or Detroit, for that matter.
Or, yes, well, you have to wonder. I think I'd go Southern California, but there you go.
Are they mostly Sunni or Shiite?
There's a mix.
But they get along?
They get along. I mean, this is, in general, you've got Yemenis from the old country who band together for that reason. And they all came to work in the steel industry, and then the steel industry, basically the bottom fell out of the steel industry in Lackawanna, and they were left sort of jobless.
I wonder why Yemenis came to work in the steel industry.
There's actually a great story as to why this happened. The Eastern Europeans came first. A lot of Polish people came, and they're working the furnaces. And the furnaces in the steel mills in Lackawanna were just blistering hot. So someone had the bright idea that if they actually brought over people who were from a very hot climate, they would have less trouble standing in front of the furnaces. And I don't know if you've ever been to Yemen, but I can tell you that it does feel quite a bit in the summer like standing in front of a furnace. And that's why a lot of the Yemenis ended up coming in.
Well, most of the steel mill workers were immigrants, whether they were Polish or Irish, and then later Yemeni, for the same reason, I guess. This was very difficult work.
Right, and Americans didn't want to do it. And so the Yemenis in this sort of, hierarchy ended up being sort of at the bottom of the heap.
And how long ago did the Yemenis start moving to Lackawanna?
It would have been in the 1950s and in great numbers in the 60s.
As you said, some of these kids were really integrated into the community. Several were soccer stars. One was even voted friendliest in his high school class by his high school class, but you said that
and married the head cheerleader.
Yeah, was she also a Muslim?
No, she was white.
You said that they lived isolated. Their section of the First Ward was on the other side of a bridge, literally the other side of the tracks. Did they prefer to live in an isolated community?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, I think it was very hard for this, teenage generation that went to school in Lackawanna to try and balance the two worlds that they were living in. They were living in a very American sort of high school world, and they were also having to come home and, try to be good Muslims. I mean, a lot of the girls in Lackawanna would actually walk to school in their abayas and their hijabs fully covered and then slip into the bathroom and put on makeup and put on jeans and be normal high school students for the day and then slip back into the bathroom and take off the makeup and put back on their abayas and hijabs and return home.
So in their community, there were mosques. In central Lackawanna, there was the Catholic Church, and it was a rather... The Catholic Church plays a large role in Lackawanna.
It does, largely because there's almost like someone told me, and I don't know if this is absolutely true, but that the basilica in downtown Lackawanna on Ridge Road was actually a mini version of St. Paul's Cathedral. And it's so out of place with this particular town. I mean, when you drive into Lackawanna, there's skeletons of old steel mills there. Actually, now they're gone, but when I first started doing the research, they were just sort of frozen amid collapse, and it's very sad. And then all of a sudden, you'd go into this small town with very little to recommend it and lots of boarded storefronts, and then you'd see this little mini version of St. Paul's Cathedral.
Our Lady of Victory?
Exactly, Our Lady of Victory.
And Father Baker was the priest in that church when the mills closed. He's now... hasn't there been a move to get Father Baker canonized?
Yes, exactly. And what I tried to do in the book is to draw this enormous sort of division between here are these trying to be devout Muslims on one side of the tracks, and then you have an entire town that's just incredibly focused on trying to turn the man who built this, built an orphanage and built this small replica of St. Paul's Cathedral, to try and get him to be a saint. And it was on the front page of the newspaper. I mean, and this is where we're going. We're closer to sainthood. This is what is, and they presented him not only as the saint, but also the savior of the actual town, because if he was made into a saint, they kept saying, it would be the economic salvation of the town. They'd have to build parking lots for the buses that would come. I mean, it was really quite, you know, as an outsider coming in, you wondered sometimes if they actually believed this.
It sounds to me like this would lead to two fortress mentalities, two separate fortress mentalities.
It's a good way to put it. I mean, if only I'd, you know, met you 6 months ago and I needed to say it that way.
Nah, it's a cliche. It's okay.
Okay.
You avoided cliches. The church did play a huge role in Lackawanna's economy, didn't it?
It did. In fact, Our Lady of Victory was the largest employer in Lackawanna because there was, in fact, a hospital and there was a large orphanage. And I guess Boys Town, is that in Nebraska? Sort of, I don't know. It's in the middle of
I saw the
somewhere,
movie so
yes,
many years ago.
There you go. Well,
Spencer
you,
Tracy.
Spencer Tracy, based on Boys Town. Well, actually, the Lackawanna orphanage came first.
Now, I'd assume that if I were a young Muslim in Lackawanna and there was all this emphasis on the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church, that I would want to get together with some of my friends and form an alternative group.
Paul, well, certainly when they were in high school, there was less of that pressure, I think. But I think when they got out of high school and graduated and realized that there wasn't much ahead for them, you know, basically their shining moment was when they were the star soccer players who voted friendliest, and then they left high school and with no prospects.
Because the mills had closed.
The mills had closed.
And the town was depressed, and Buffalo isn't exactly a booming town either.
No, at all. And between those two things, there was really nothing for them to look forward to. So they sort of found solace, I guess, in being together as Muslims and trying to be better Muslims. And
they call themselves the Arabian Nights?
Well, that was in high school. They used to wear jackets that actually had this moniker painted on the back.
And into this comes Kamal Dervish. Now, had he lived in Lackawanna before?
Indeed. He had been born in Lackawanna and had moved away from Lackawanna as a small child. His father had been basically fired from the mills. So he returned to Saudi Arabia, and Kamal went with him and his family and became a very devout Muslim following Wahhabism, and then returned to Lackawanna in, I guess, 99 or 2000 and seemed like the prodigal son returning. And he knew something about Islam that the young men in Lackawanna had never really experienced before.
Well, Wahhabism would have been strange to most American Muslims, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. In 2000, would it still have been? I don't know. I think more people had gone to schools and madrasas that were actually funded by the Saudis, so they would have at least touched on Wahhabism. But certainly his returning and being able to, you know, talk about the Quran in a way that these boys had never heard before, not because it's Wahhabism, but just because it was erudite. To that point, being a Muslim in Lackawanna was more about earnestness than being erudite, and that's what Kamal Dervish brought.
Weren't the community's elders suspicious of him?
They were indeed. He came and sort of gave a fiery speech in the mosque, and they said, you know, we want nothing to do with you. If you want to make those kind of speeches, you make them somewhere else, which was problematic in the sense that that's exactly what he did. He started making speeches in his apartment, and he would basically offer free pizza after the mosque. They would discuss what had happened in the mosque, and young men would come there. And I'd talked to some who actually weren't part of the six but had come there on a regular basis. And I said, you know, it was interesting. We learned a little bit more about what it was like to be Muslim. But more than that, the pizza was free.
So these were Muslim discussion groups, or was he also functioning as a recruiter?
There's gray area there. I think it started out as a Muslim discussion group. But depending on who you believe, Kamal Dervish had come there for a very specific reason, and that was to either start his own sort of small factional army that he could take back to Yemen, or to actually recruit for al-Qaeda. And uh, he was a member of Al-Qaeda. They know that. There was a lot of gray area in this story, but of the various gray areas, Kamel Darwish is about as dark as it gets.
My guest is Dina Temple Raston, who has written a book called The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. It's published by Public Affairs. As you probably know, Dina Temple Raston is NPR's FBI correspondent, and maybe later we'll get into whether an FBI correspondent should be writing this book or whether she's the only one who might know enough because she's an FBI correspondent to write this book. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Dina Temple Raston, who is National Public Radio's FBI correspondent and the author of a number of books. Her new one, The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror, is published by Public Affairs. Were you working on this while you were working at NPR?
No, actually. I finished it about 6 months before I started at NPR. And, you know, the case I made to NPR to hire me as their FBI correspondent was that in researching this book, I learned a lot about how the FBI works, but also made a lot of contacts out in the field offices, which is where the rubber meets the road when it comes to the FBI.
Are there people in the FBI who disagree with the way this case has been handled?
Yes.
What made the young men in this group decide to go to Afghanistan? I know you said before it was before 9/11, but there must have been, that's a big adventure for somebody from Lackawanna, New York.
Well, you actually have hit it. The nail right on the head. It was a big adventure, and that's what they were looking for.
With wives and children?
Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. These are not sort of stellar individuals who went. I mean, they didn't have all that much responsibility, and they were in their 20s, and they were offered what they thought would be an adventure of a lifetime. Now, some people disagree about why exactly they went. The FBI, some in the FBI would tell you that they went knowing that it was going to be an anti-American camp. Others say that they thought they might end up being warriors in Chechnya or Bosnia. And you can't underestimate that for young Muslims, what was going on in Bosnia and Chechnya and how that resonated with them.
Do you think any of them knew who Osama bin Laden was?
I think they had an idea of who he was, yes. But did they have a full understanding of what, for example, the bombing in the USS Cole was really about, or that they were going to a camp that could possibly be anti-American? I think there was a spectrum of understanding from incredible naivete to maybe some savvy on that.
Did any of them meet Osama bin Laden?
Actually, they did. All of them met him once. One of them met him twice. And you know, it's quite amazing when you think about it. Here we are looking for Osama bin Laden in, you know, the deserts of Pakistan or Afghanistan. And yet these sort of six hapless guys not only get into a camp and spend time with Osama bin Laden, but get to meet him twice. And the first time he was telling them, he came to announce that there would be a joining of Zawahiri's Islamic forces and those of Al-Qaeda. And the second time, there was actually like an exit interview because Sahim Alwan, who is one of the six, one of the older of the six and more responsible of the six, faked an injury to leave the camp early. And so he had an exit interview with Osama bin Laden. And they were sitting together and Osama actually says to him, what do your brothers in America feel, or your Muslim brothers feel about suicide attacks? To which he sort of stopped still, and he thought, well, the answer that he wants, of course, is that we are all eager to do this. But instead, the answer that popped out of his mouth was, you know what, Muslims in America don't even consider this. It didn't even occur to us, and you know, we get to practice our religion. There's no reason for us to do this. And he saw Osama bin Laden's face kind of fall. And he thought just momentarily, oh no, I've given the wrong answer. And maybe I'm not going to get to go home. And instead, Osama bin Laden just sort of nodded and said, do you need your passport, you know, scrubbed? And do you have stamps in there that are problematic? And, you know, God be with you, and left him.
So he wanted to leave. Were they all anxious to leave, or did some buy into what Osama was saying?
Some bought into them. And in fact, the one who really bought into it was Jabir Ilbana, who is a guy who's still depending on how you look at it, at large in Yemen. He is, the FBI jokes that he's on a catch-and-release program in Yemen, that they capture him, wait to see how they might split up the $5 million bounty on his head, can't decide how to split it up, and then release him again. But he's somewhere in Yemen. And he had actually said to Sahim Alwan, when it first started, Sahim said, "This stuff is scary. I think we should go." Jabhat al-Banna said, "No, I'm ready to martyr myself." So he really bought into it.
Hadn't the FBI been monitoring the Yemeni community before 9/11?
Well, no, not really. That's what's actually interesting about this. They had some relationship with the Yemeni community in Lackawanna after the USS Cole bombing, but for completely different reasons, not to monitor them, but in fact they were concerned that there was going to be hate crimes against them post USS Cole bombing. And then in addition to that, after 9/11, again, they were worried about hate crimes there. But what's amazing about this story that most people don't realize is that the way the FBI found out that these guys were in the camps was because someone in the Muslim community of Lackawanna wrote an anonymous letter to one of the main characters in the book, Ed Needham, an FBI agent in the Buffalo office, and had named names and said, "I'm very frightened, and these boys have gone to an Al-Qaeda camp. There are more boys who are waiting to go. And, you know, I thought you should know." And as Ed Needham started checking these things out, you know, these guys were still at the camps when this happened. So they were monitored from the moment that they came back.
And Kamel Dervish was convincing others to go?
He had already convinced others to go, but he never came back. He never came back. But yes, he had already convinced. There was a second group of young men that were prepared to go and had raised the money to go. And then, you know, 3 months after the first group came back, 9/11 happened.
And the FBI kind of arrested these guys?
No, they waited a full year.
Why? Why did they wait so long?
Well, they were, or you could you could ask the question a different way.
Why did they arrest them at all? Because they hadn't really committed a crime.
Or why did they arrest them on nearly the exact anniversary of 9/11 and not 6 months before or six after?
Mm-hmm.
And actually,
I can't imagine why.
Well, you know, it's funny. FBI Director Mueller and I have a disagreement over this particular issue. I describe in the book a meeting between FBI Director Mueller, Vice President Cheney, and President Bush, in which he had actually been briefing them daily for months about what the Lackawanna Six were doing. And, of course, they were doing nothing, which must have been very, very difficult to keep briefing them and saying, "No, actually, no, they still haven't made a phone call. No, they still aren't acting suspicious. No, they haven't bought explosives." And so finally, Vice President Cheney said to the director, "Well, can you give me 100% guarantee that they're not going to do anything?" And Mueller said, "Well, no, of course not. But we're watching them very carefully, and they don't seem to be doing anything." And Cheney or Bush, unclear, I've had two different versions of the story, said, "Arrest them."
And what did they say, that they had been on a religious trip?
Exactly. Exactly. They said they had been in madrasas in Pakistan. In fact, their families didn't even know. Their families thought they had gone to Pakistan as well.
My guest is NPR's Dina Temple-Raston. Her book, The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six, and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror, published by Public Affairs. What was the basis of the government's case against them if they hadn't done anything?
Material support. They were arrested. The first of the Lackawanna Six was arrested in Bahrain on September 9, 2002.
What does material support mean?
Well, now it has a little better definition than it did then, but essentially it means if you do almost anything that might be construed as being helpful to a terrorist group. In this case, they had bought uniforms and sleeping bags and this sort of thing, and they considered that to be material support.
Was there any email correspondence that they engaged in?
Well, they did. There was the occasional sort of email or phone call to Kamel Dervish. And clearly these were monitored in the most precise way. And so nothing was planned as far as they knew. I think what happened is they were arrested partly because in the run-up to 9/11, to the anniversary of 9/11, there was a lot of chatter, as we know from everything that we hear about 9/11. And Mukhtar al-Bakri, one of the six, the youngest of the six, was actually in Bahrain. And they were quite concerned that Mukhtar was there to do some sort of damage to an American base. And he had called his friends. He was there, actually, for a wedding. And we know that big wedding has been a quote, has been a sort of code for some sort of big attack among al-Qaeda members.
Although there are weddings.
And in this case, indeed, there was one. Mukhtar, the book opens actually with Mukhtar al-Bakri is under the sheets with his new teenage bride for the first time. And he's about to consummate his marriage. And the door bursts open. Bahraini police stream into the room, surround his bed, muzzles sort of their guns trained on Mukhtar al-Bakri. And they're expecting to see suicide vests and explosives and all kinds of things. And instead, there's just sort of this young guy looking very scared and this sort of teenage bride in tears. And as they're bundling him down the hall, he keeps on saying, "Wait, wait, I haven't consummated my marriage yet." So apparently he never got to.
To this day, is he still in prison?
He's still in prison.
Well, but the people in Lackawanna, there was a trial, wasn't there?
No. No, there wasn't.
Was there? Did they hire lawyers? What was the response of the community?
It was sort of mixed. In the beginning, the Muslim community in Lackawanna, you know, the timing of the arrest, whether, I mean, the FBI claims that this is just the way that it worked out, although it's very hard to believe that, given that it was almost exactly on the anniversary of 9/11 and gave them a perfect opportunity to say, see, we're cracking down, war on terror, we're winning it. The problem with the Lackawanna 6 case is that you really couldn't unring the 9/11 bell. And this was everybody's worst fear, that the people among us were actually our enemies and that these secret cells were everywhere. And if they could be in Lackawanna, and this was actually a quote of the mayor from Lackawanna as they announced these arrests, if it could be here, it could be anywhere. And it just really sort of frothed this all up. There was a real question as to whether or not it would go to trial. They had court-appointed lawyers, and it became very clear, and this is discussed in the book, it became very clear that it would be hard for them to have a fair trial because you couldn't unring the 9/11 bell and because they seemed to represent everything we were frightened of.
And where are they now? Are they all in jail?
Well, originally, this is another interesting thing that happened in this case, is originally they were they took plea agreements, and they got between 7 and 9 years, and they were promised to be in jail somewhere around Lackawanna so their families could visit them. Then about 6 months ago, the Bureau of Corrections had the brilliant idea that they should take all the terrorists in America, I guess this would be convicted terrorists and admitted terrorists in America, and put them in the same prison. And so they are now in a prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, in a special communications monitoring unit where apparently everything they say and do is very, very carefully monitored. And, of course, the Lackawanna 6, who at one point were all separate, are now all together on the same cell block in Indiana.
Well, we know that when people who are petty criminals are put into prison with hardened criminals, they often come out hardened criminals. Is this experience putting them together with real radicals likely to radicalize them?
It wouldn't take a brain surgeon to put those two things together. I mean, it just seems to me they were very hapless sort of keystone wannabe jihadists and very unclear whether or not violence was really something that was something that they considered. But you have to think the first of the Lackawanna 6 could get out next year. And you have to wonder, is he going to get out as being a chastised American, or is he going to come out being a, you know, fervent jihadist like never before? And I think that is the question that's before us now.
You have collaborated with Anthony D. Romero of the Civil Liberties Union on a book called In Defense of Our America, The Fight for Civil Liberties in the Age of Terror. Were you working on this book at the same time?
Exactly, yes.
And do you see them as being part of the same project?
No, not at all. They're very different.
Were the Lackawanna 6's civil liberties violated in this case?
I wouldn't say the Lackawanna 6. I would say that there are two other people who are involved in the story who are, there's Kamel Derwish that we talked about, who is an American. The way he met his end is with a Predator missile that the Americans shot at a convoy in Yemen. He was never actually indicted of anything or accused of anything, but he was an American who was summarily executed. I would say probably almost anyone would think his civil liberties were probably violated in doing that. There was actually a Black Ops army guy who went to the smoldering ashes of this convoy and broke open the femur that they thought it was Derwish's and took his DNA to make sure they'd gotten him.
Did you travel to Afghanistan to do any research on this book?
I did more than that. I followed in the footsteps of the Lackawanna Six because I thought to have any sort of understanding of what they went through, I had to go through it too, to a certain extent. So I traveled from their villages in Yemen through Pakistan, through the jihadi hotels where they stayed, snuck across the border of Afghanistan at Spin Boldek, where they did, and then went right to the precipice of the Lackawanna camp, the Al-Qaeda camp, which is not there anymore.
Were people willing to talk to you?
Sort of. I mean, it wasn't super easy. Pakistan, what we're seeing in Pakistan now, I was there last year. What we're seeing in Pakistan now, you could see the wheels starting to come off last year. Afghanistan, we left... I guess I went with a photographer friend of mine, Conrad Fiedler, who works for the New York Sun. And we left Afghanistan, I guess, in late September. And that was when the suicide bombings that we're now hearing as a weekly affair in Afghanistan had just started.
My guest has been Dina Temple Raston, who's written a book called The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. It is published by Public Affairs. And she will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Half King on West 23rd Street and 10th Avenue. Just one more question very quickly. How has the town of Lackawanna dealt with this more recently?
They're trying to put it behind them as much as they can. It's interesting because now I'm getting a lot of the feedback from the book. And the FBI is a little grumpy about things, and some of the family members of the Lackawanna Six are a little grumpy about it, which means, I think, I probably got it about right.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Dina Temple Raston will be listening to you on NPR.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.